Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Front Porch Conversation on Justice. We welcome you to this episode on this Thursday afternoon, where we're having conversations about biblical and social justice issues. It is our intent to talk about issues that are relevant to times such as this, whatever that may look like. We welcome your participation in the topics that are being discussed. Believe it or not, we believe that you have just as much to contribute to the conversation as our invited guest. Today we are discussing racism and the church. We'll be taking a look at the historical and present day implicit and explicit biases of the church as it relates to race and racism. We are delighted to have with us today the Reverend Daniel Wilson, the pastor of Williamsburg Baptist Church in Williamsburg, Virginia, to talk about this important topic. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
We're having some technical problems with Reverend Wilson, and we'll be back with you in a few minutes. Thank you. We got Reverend Wilson on the line now. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
We're finally working through this maze of problems. We can get started with this topic for the day. And as I told the audience previously, we're talking about racism in the church, and we're very fortunate to have you with us today. So I'd like to start off, if you would tell us a little bit about the Reverend Daniel Wilson and how he got where he is today.
Oh, my goodness. let's see. I was born in a very conservative Christian context, the son of a missionary kid and a pastor's kid. My mother is Brazilian and my father is American, but grew up in Brazil as a missionary kid. And my first memories are of church. I eventually felt a call into ministry around my just after graduating high school, and went to a very conservative Bible college in Florida, majored in Bible, and then went off to seminary. And already my mind started to really look at my own tradition and think through some of the things that I pretty much took for granted. And I kind of joke around with folks that there was a time when becoming an evangelical was a paradigm shift for me. I was raised in a pretty fundamentalist context. And so I went to an evangelical seminary up in Philadelphia, and my mind continued to change on some things. And so about partway through the program there, I decided to transfer to something of a more progressive seminary. So I went to Fuller Theological Seminary out in Pasadena and finished my MDiv there, my seminary degree there. And then I went to Duke Divinity School after that to do another degree, and then went into pastoral ministry there. So my mind has definitely evolved on some things. And so right now, as you mentioned earlier, I'm pastor at Williamsburg Baptist Church. We're just across the street from the College of William and Mary, and about a block and a half from Colonial Williamsburg. So I'm trying to do justice and peace ministry here, and work with the congregation. I've been here for about 2 years, and it's really been a fun time. I think a challenging time too, trying to get ingrained in this community and to get to know our people and to see what God can do here.
That's wonderful. Well, looking at the topic we have today, Daniel, looking at the church as it relates to race and racism, and taking it from a historical perspective until present day time, to look at those implicit and explicit biases that are present. And I assume through your journey and talking with you somewhat that some of these things have been very relevant in your life. So I guess we'll start off, let's just back up and take it from a historical perspective in terms of the church and and its role in perpetuating racism, or if you think it hasn't, or do you think the church has been a neutral body in it?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's another long discussion. I think, you know, one thing that's been important to me was coming to the realization that sometimes to bear truthful witness to the church, to what the church has done, we have to have some tough conversations. I find that people are really interested in the church just trying to fess up to its history, its very complicated history. Sometimes people, for evangelistic reasons, want to make the church sound like, oh, this is, you know, we're perfect. We're, you know, or even if we're not perfect, we're just forgiven. And they kind of turn a blind eye to what the church has done in history, or they try to separate themselves from what the church has done in the past. And, you know, I have to say, you know, I don't find that to be very helpful anymore. I find that a lot of people are really interested in encountering Christians who say, yeah, the church has done a lot, and I'm still a Christian because I've seen the better side of things, and I've seen how we can witness to the peace and the justice and the beauty of God, you know, and learn from these tragedies. And so I find that people are a lot more interested in that than hearing somebody talk about how the church hasn't done anything in the past. So I think in light of that, especially when it comes to, you know, matters of race, my gosh, where do you begin? I think that the biblical story itself is full of these sort of group dynamics where people are constantly fearful of, you know, quote unquote, the other. And I think, like, even right now, we're going through a series on the prophets in our Sunday school class. And I'm doing Jonah this week. And just the sort of situations, the social dynamics that gave rise to a message like Jonah, I don't think that Jonah is often understood by many Christians today. We kind of make it a story about this guy that got swallowed up by a fish, but that's hardly the point. The point is really, if I had a chance to rename the book of Jonah, it would probably be something like Jonah and Assyria, rather than Jonah and the whale. And that's because Assyria, this bloodthirsty empire that's constantly nipping at the heels of the northern kingdom of Israel and would eventually overtake the northern kingdom of Israel in the 8th century BC. You know, these are people that Jonah hated, not out of any sense of racism per se, but out of a sense of violence. You know, that these people, the Assyrians, were expanding their empire and were threatening the northern kingdom of Israel. And to ask Jonah to go preach repentance would be, you know, kind of like, you know, as I've sort of characterized it, it'd be like asking a Jewish rabbi in 1942 to go prophesy repentance to Berlin. You know, that's just a crazy, crazy scenario. And we don't quite appreciate that when we read the book of Jonah all the time. And, you know, the message, if you carry that fact into your reading of the book of Jonah, you start to read toward the end about how Jonah is just waiting for judgment to fall on Nineveh, not because he's a spiteful person, but because he regards justice. You know, he's a just person. And, and he wants justice to be meted out in a retributional way. And God leaves Jonah and the reader with a question at the end of the book about how God can bring God's self to destroy this city with so many inhabitants, these people who don't know their right hand from their left. And so a lot of scholars think that this story was written much later in Israel's history about the historical Jonah, this historical prophet Jonah. And it was written to say, you know, how are we going to interact with our oppressors? How are we going to interact with our enemies? Are we going to wish that God judges them, or are we going to hope that God's mercy extends beyond the boundaries of Israel? And that's a real question that the people of God had to wrestle with. It's something that we have to wrestle with. And even later in the New Testament, the early church has to wrestle with the fact that God is opening up the borders of Israel to non-Jews, to Gentiles. And that's also something that I think the church takes for granted. And so we see at the very foundation of the church, there is this idea of race, not merely biology and heredity, but race, as in culture, as well as heredity to some extent, but culture, religion. God is opening up the boundaries of Israel to people outside the fold. And that's something that that has repercussions that are very, very similar, I think, to the racialized context that we have today.
Okay, so coming forward from that biblical perspective, as you brought up in culture and religion, as we look at the church now, and specifically society and its worldview, split into many categories and being defined at the moment by politics and culture and religion. But how is religion or the church evolving, or has it evolved in a sense, or is it still trapped somewhere that it can't even identify itself? It has no identity.
Wow. I think we have to be I think we have to be very specific about what we mean by the church. I think that this when you think about the global church, I want to talk about how the West interacts with the rest of the church. How the church outside the West interacts with other churches outside the West. So there's that dynamic. When we talk about the church in America specifically and racial politics in the U.S., it goes across the board. You have, whether it's, white folks or African-American folks or Hispanics, and so on and so on, who sort of fall behind the legacy of, just for example, Dr. King. You've got those folks still trying to seek racial reconciliation, still trying to seek justice, trying to improve the situation however they can in their own context. Then you've got, I think, a lot of folks who are just silent on the matter, who know what's right but are afraid for whatever reason to really pursue a program of racial reconciliation, if I could use that term. And then there are churches that are roadblocks to that, I believe. We just saw this all play out in the Southern Baptist Convention with their gathering recently. The Southern Baptist, and I'll just say for any of our listeners, I'm not a Southern Baptist pastor. The Williamsburg Baptist Church has not been a Southern Baptist church for a few decades now. But I will say, as an outside observer, it was very noticeable that the SBC had trouble passing a condemnation of the alt-right. And the fact that it was pushed, I think, is encouraging. The fact that it was that twice the measure failed is discouraging for our SBC siblings. I think that was a black eye. It got a lot of national attention, and I think it was definitely something that speaks. The damage is done, is what I'm trying to say, and I think it speaks volumes. But they were able to get something passed, and. And I'd say that the whole spectrum in some manner is really embodied in that one gathering, that there are people who are trying to pushed for positive change. There are people who just don't care and are silent about it. And then there are others who actively oppose it, and all somehow in the name of their common Christian beliefs. So
okay. So how's this term that's being loosely thrown around these days, evangelicals, playing into this whole topic?
yeah, that's the $50,000 question, I suppose. You know, scholars, you know, historians of American religion and American church history, as well as British church history and sociologists of religion, all have a wonderful time at conferences trying to debate what precisely constitutes an evangelical. And I actually was interviewed for a piece for the Daily Beast on whether how people hold on to the term evangelical. I mean, you can have, you know, someone as a far right as Franklin Graham, you know, embrace the term. You've got middle of the road folks like Wheaton College out in the Chicago area, you know, embracing the term. And then you've got sort of like leftward progressive folks like Fuller Seminary or Tony Campolo, you know, all also embracing the term. And those folks would not have a very fun lunch together. The evangelical moniker is something where I say there's about, you know, 8 or 9 traits. And then if you have at least 5 of them, you're probably an evangelical. So it's really hard to define. I know that the recent election, presidential election, definitely was a factor in the latest factor in understanding what an evangelical was. Of course, we have pollsters to thank for that, however they defined an evangelical. Mm-hmm. But also we know that there was by their definitions and standards for polling, there was a huge evangelical turnout, a white evangelical turnout for Trump. And so that definitely has played into, I think, a number of people identifying more closely with the term, and another group of people finding it less possible to identify with the term. And so I know that for myself, I don't mind describing myself as a progressive evangelical, because there are still many, many aspects of evangelical identity that I would call my own. But at the same time, I do have trouble after the presidential election sort of identifying with that term. And at the same time, I know that there are others who have had difficulty for one reason or another identifying with the term, even though, you know, some of those trademarks, which are, you know, intense evangelical piety or spiritual piety, intense energy for mission, you know, regard for scripture. I own all of that. And yet the way that I see those things handled sometimes by evangelicals raises a number of questions and concerns for me. I know I would also, you know, point to race as one factor too. And I've pushed this book before. I should probably start getting royalties from the publisher. But I've pushed the book Divided by Faith, Evangelical Religion and the Problem of Race in America. It's by Oxford University Press, and it's written by 2 sociologists of religion, Michael Emerson and Christian Smith. And they really tell the story well. It's one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of the book. They tell the story well of how evangelicals both perpetuated and perpetuated racism, and also became thoroughly involved in fighting racism. And then they sort of explore the social dynamics and even theological dynamics that that make that such a complex story. And one of the things that that they identify as a big problem for evangelicals is that evangelical theology tends to prioritize the individual. Right. And oftentimes disables the evangelical imagination from even conceiving of something like structural racism or systemic racism, because, you know, a collective consciousness or a collective identity is often not what evangelicals are working with when they read their Bibles or they pray or they read their devotional literature. And, you know, I just had a conversation with a number of pastors this week about this very thing, that whether it's our religious life, our life of faith, or even American individualism, we are really conditioned by our environment to really think of the individual, think of ourselves as the ultimate focus of our lived experience. We seldom think in terms of an us or a we, or even if we do, it's not in a very influential way. When I talk about this, you know, how this relates to the Bible, of thinking of yourself as part of the people of God, this is a really strange notion for a lot of people. They're not used to thinking of that concept of the people of God as extending, back through the Old Testament to Abraham, even if they are, even if that concept is present in their vocabulary, they haven't thought very deeply about it and about how we are an extenuation of this family of faith. And to learn from our spiritual ancestors, as it were, or to even have an ancestry is kind of a novel idea to them. They think of ancestry as at best what you might be able to find on ancestry.com or something like that, but we seldom look at the Bible as our family history. And I think that's a notable omission.
So with the lack of reflection, we're going back to what you said about the environment being the basis of this faith versus American individualism. So we can't connect the Bible as being part of that shared history, or we just isolate that as something that's just there that perpetuates something.
Yeah, I think the Bible is often looked at as two things, at least. One, it's a mechanism for salvation. And then, we have to go back to see what people sort of consider to be salvation. And that's a discussion unto itself. And the Bible is also seen as a compendium of morality. And so people sort of pick and choose what morals, and I'm talking about conservatives and progressives, people pick and choose what morals in the Bible they consider to be normative, and then, use it as a way to harness the young, whereas the focus on salvation is often a way to give comfort to the old. And so those two, I think, social objectives become the grid that, whether we realize it or not, oftentimes we push the Bible through. And I think that is sort of accounted for by our failure to really capture the imaginations of our youth. And, the exodus that we're seeing from in churches of young people, because we've turned it into these ways to harness the young and give comfort to the old. But we haven't seen the Bible as something that is formative of our imaginations, that really ushers us into a story. And emphasis is really on story, a story that God tells that sometimes doesn't give us clear and easy answers, but at least it enmeshes in a conversation of how we can bear witness to justice and peace and love in our own context. And we do that by learning from the stories of our spiritual ancestors.
So the whole perspective there lends itself to going back to this whole thing about the evangelical. And not your five defining progressive evangelical ways, but I'll look past that. But we're looking at this whole theory of isolationism as it perpetuates in terms of the environment. So does that perpetuate that whole thing of belonging to or wanting to be with folks that look like me, or on a Sunday morning or on a daily basis in activity at home, and only in those uncontrolled environments we have no choice to mixture, but we don't do it in a way that brings about any cohesive intermingling or
sure.
gathering. So.
Yeah, I think when you that raises a great point. I think when you sort of reduce the Bible to those mechanisms and you really prioritize the individual, the Bible kind of loses its power to call us to what one of my professors called the conversion of the imagination. You know, we, instead of being challenged by the rich and complex story of the Bible, we tend to fall into more weightier influences like individualism. We give in to the sort of reptilian strategies of fight or flight. And that often, turns itself into a journey to feel comfortable. You know, in our consumerism, which is another huge social dynamic, we seek church out. We seek to embody ways of safety that tend to surround us with comfort, and that usually means people who look like us, people who think like us. There is not a very great desire there for diversity. And so those places where that diversity is most clearly represented in Scripture, those parts get muted. You know, we look at the Good Samaritan story, for example, as a story about being nice to people in need, and that's not the point of the story at all. Like, everybody knows you're supposed to be nice to people in need. That's not why Jesus tells the story. You know, Jesus tells the story because the scribe, you know, the Torah scholar asks him, well, who's my neighbor? Because he went up to Jesus and asked him, you know, what do you do to have eternal life? And Jesus says, you know, what do you think? And he says, well, love God and neighbor with all that you are. And you know, I'm paraphrasing, but Jesus says, you're right. And then, you know, love your neighbor as yourself is part of it, right out of Leviticus. And he wants to justify himself, the text tells us. He wants to justify himself, and which should cause readers to scratch their heads. Well, what does he want to justify himself about? And he asks the question, who is my neighbor? And that is a real question, because in different parts of Torah, you kind of get different answers to that question. And so rabbis would debate which is more important, you know, to be a neighbor to your fellow Israelite, or to be a neighbor to everyone, whether it's fellow Israelite or the stranger in the land. And Jesus's answer, the answer to that question, who is my neighbor, is to put a Samaritan, who is a political enemy, a racial outcast, and a religious heretic, in the role of the model neighbor. And so when Jesus ends that story, he asks the Torah scholar, so who acted neighborly? And the Torah scholar can't even say the Samaritan. Like, he's too embarrassed. He can't even admit it. He just says the one who showed mercy and walks away. He walks away. So you know, we turn that story into a story about the Samaritan being nice to the person on the side of the road. That's just a prop. That's not the reason Jesus tells the story. But you know, when we have given our minds over to, and I'll use my old fundamentalist language, when we become worldly in our thinking, you know, we tend to fall to those social dynamics that are weightier than our biblical imagination. And one of those things is consumerism. The other is fear of the other. And so we'll seek to embody those in our worship, and our worship will be very, you know, in some cases it'll be very white and very Protestant and evangelical. And in other cases it'll be, you know, owing to other traditions. And so I think, again, when we reduce the Bible to just these simple little objectives, whether we realize we're doing it or not, we fall prey to larger cultural forces. And one of those is seeking homogeneity in our communities of faith.
So in your pastorship or your walk, how do you address these issue of breaking the power of the past, these failings of the past? I mean, how do you work towards that and break that mindset of the illustrative stories or metaphors in the Bible that people look at on face value and not take
forward? Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that I ask myself all the time because I'm still figuring it out as a young pastor. I think, you know, I look at my own story. I'm half Brazilian, and I was raised by an immigrant woman. I didn't even realize how much racism I had seen until I took a graduate class at Fuller Seminary. And shout out to Dr. Love Seacrest. She is an amazing professor down there at Fuller, but she taught a class on, it was called Race and Identity in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And I took the class because I was really interested in Jewish-Christian relations, and I was really interested in how Christianity became its own religion and not just a sect of Judaism. And so I took the class for those reasons, but I ended up getting half the class, was basically just critical race theory. And so I realized in that class a few things, to say the least, one of which was that I had actually been dealing with racism my entire life. You know, I always wondered why people were harsh or said this, that, or the other. And then after taking that class, I thought, oh my goodness, I was being treated like an immigrant.
I was encountering anti-immigrant sentiment, and I thought people were just being mean. And so it really gave me eyes to contextualize a lot of my experiences and some of my mother's experiences as well. But another thing that I realized was that my colorblindness was really inadequate to deal with the full measure of the problem of race in America. And so for that, I'm ever, forever grateful to Dr. Seacrest the rest is sort of history. I've been on a mission to try to understand race, the problems. I'm reading a great book right now by Willie Jennings, who used to teach at Duke, now teaches at Yale. The book's called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. It's pretty hefty if you haven't had a philosophy or theology background, but still there's some remarkable things that he says, and it's a fantastic meditation on why things are the way they are today. But I've continued in different directions to try to understand how to cope with this problem, especially from the perspective of a predominantly white congregation. You know, I'll say that Williamsburg Baptist is a predominantly white congregation. We do have people from a lot of different backgrounds, from different Asian descents, and we have Hispanic folks, including myself. I'm Latino. We have some African American folks, Native American folks who worship with us. And I'm very grateful that things seem to keep growing more and more diverse by the year, especially having the campus across the street. That's been a real blessing for us. But one of the things really is trying to re-narrate the scriptures, and you can only really do that with some heavy lifting. Actually, let me back up even further. The greatest asset that you can have in this effort is patience. Or as I like to call it, sort of a balance between the activist and the moderate. The activist and the gradualist. I like to say I have the heart of an activist and the mind of a gradualist. Okay. And depending on how the day goes, you might, you know, one side might have a good day, the other side might have a bad day, and that's okay as long as somebody has a good day. but the, you know, gradualism, I think, gets a bad rap. And that's because so often gradualism is seen as a, and just for our listeners who might be wondering what I'm talking about, gradualism is that belief that things move slowly. And so racial reconciliation in particular, you know, we should just understand that things move slowly, and we shouldn't be so activistic. And that's the problem with gradualism. And I sympathize with that problem, is that oftentimes gradualism becomes an excuse for not doing more. And I don't believe in that. Like, I don't believe that that it should be used as an excuse to do more. If you can do more, do more. Don't use gradualism as an excuse or as a means of quieting activism. But at the same time, I realize that societies move slowly, that movements move slowly, and that you have to have a good gradualist ground game to back up your activist, you know. You know, this battle is too important to just work on one front. And right. I think we all need those solid, you know, stalwarts that will be in the trenches and be there for a long time, you know, stay rooted in a community and work to chip away at resistance to diversity little by little. But also you need those activists. I'll put it this way, you know, baseball is a good metaphor for this. You know, not everybody is a power hitter. In a lineup, you know, you've got some people who are a lot better at just getting on base. I think that when it comes to social change, you need those power hitters. You need those activists who can swing for the fences and who can, you know, drive in some runs. But you also need some base hitters, you know, who can just make small progress through just culture building or culture rebuilding. Or cultural subverting, you know, however long that does. And I think a lot of activists get burned out because the only activism that they know is that sort of systemic structural change. But we need people to realize that even in the course of a lifetime, you may not be able to do much more than just make a bunch of little base hits, so to speak. And that's right. Okay too, because it's still progress. And so in my church context, you know, you have to lay down some groundwork for the biblical narrative. I think that pastors really struggle with this, and at least from the preaching ministries that I've been under and that I've been exposed to, I think that that there is a shortage of pastors who really have a full-fledged scriptural imagination. Pastors who really know the history behind the scriptures as well as the message of the scriptures themselves. And I think, you know, for all of you folks who are considering going to seminary, drink deeply, you know, learn as much as you can, and then don't stop learning. You know, I had the good fortune of being exposed to people who approached seminary like someone was approaching medical school. You know, like for pastors, you have to know a lot, you have to know a little about a lot. You know, you're almost like a general practitioner. You have to keep abreast of a lot of different developments, and you have to know a little bit about a lot. And then for you future seminary professors out there, you're like specialists. You're like cardiologists or neurosurgeons. You know, you specialize on one thing, and you have very deep knowledge in that one thing. And you further knowledge by your research in that area. And so I think for pastors, you know, drink deeply from the study of the scriptures. Even, you know, don't be afraid to geek out every once in a while and read a dissertation. You know, that's something that has enriched my own practice. And so I really approach this as, you know, part of my ministry is family, and part of my ministry is just downright professional. I try to act like a professional when it comes to my own study and awareness of best practices and things like that. So lay down a scriptural ground game. Be patient. when and be active in your community. I know I'm trust me, I know how busy pastors are. I'm a solo pastor myself. I don't have a pastoral staff. I've got a part-time music minister and a part-time children and youth person. But at the same time, you know, I know what it's like to be completely busy. But I would say, you know, prioritize getting out into the community and keeping your, even if you can't be involved, keep your ear to the ground, keep your finger on the pulse of your community. I can't think of any other metaphors for it right now, but I mean, the message is yeah. Just get involved and see what's happening. And to the best that you can, try to knit points of contact with between your congregation and what's going on in the community. We've been able to see a number of community initiatives here in Williamsburg, community groups start to be have board members come from our church.
Great.
And so they're really getting involved in one effort or another. And so I think that that's great. I hope it bleeds more into the congregation. I hope the congregation bleeds more into the community. And in that way, you know, we will really see, you know, what some people call a church without walls. And that's really what we're trying to be.
That's great. Well, you know, you brought up a host of questions to me when you were just talking. And,
mm-hmm.
But I'm gonna just narrow it down since we only have about 12 minutes left.
Sure.
And try to get at something that's sticking it, even though we keep crossing this bridge, and especially when I'm referring to Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And especially when this discussion comes up in the church, whether it's Black church or white, predominantly Black or predominantly white church, it seems to go along the same lines. And the justification using the Bible, and they're saying, and I'm asking the question of them, you know, how can you say that you're spiritually mature or a spiritually maturing Christian while you remain emotionally immature? So how do you see that in relation to this whole thing with Black Lives Matter movement and addressing that issue, especially in this time as we've seen some prominent things happening in the news?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I am very hopeful and fearful at the same time for our young movements. And I think that our current situation exposes another disparity in our society, not just a disparity of race, but also a disparity of generations. I think that young people are angry and they're frustrated. I also think that definitely bleeds into their activism. And for whatever reason, sometimes while their ideals are really interesting, I don't always get the feeling that our young folks are into pragmatics or practical steps toward that vision. And when they're disappointed, yeah, there's a lot of rage. There's a lot of anger. I wish. You know, and I think this is not a panacea or a silver bullet, you know, solution. But I think that older generations, and in particular older generations who have fought those battles, I think there's a great need for young people to hear perspective. To hear stories of people who have been activistic their whole lives and still are struggling to see the change that they want to bring about. I think they need to hear about pragmatics and a history of organizing. But the problem is that oftentimes, and this is my challenge to older generations who have been in the trenches, oftentimes it comes across as you should do it this way. Or, you know, I did it this way, so that means you need to do it this way. Or or there's a separation. I've actually seen, you know, there's a gentleman who, you know, was very active in the civil rights movement in the 60s. And I saw him come along, a young guy, and just completely disparage him and how spoiled they are. You know, that rhetoric just doesn't help. What young people need is perspective. They need guidance. They need, you know, wisdom. But that doesn't always take the form of you have to do it the way that we did it, or you know, I had the real struggle, you don't have the real struggle. That's just not helpful.
So flipping that list, flipping that point, then how can the more established churches and I'm speaking to in the Baptist realm more so become less that of one that's sitting back saying you need to do it my way or we just don't do it at all.
Right.
You know, because I think it's I agree with you in terms that there needs to be more dialogue and understanding between the generations, but how do we get there? Yeah. We're stuck on this thing, this whatever this thing is. In terms of the 5 points, I'm going to remember that to the day I die, of evangelicalism. So I'll let you expound on that. So.
My goodness. that's a money question, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do we do it? Gosh, the phrase eyes on the prize comes to mind. I think we have to be clear about what our common shared vision is.
Mm-hmm.
That we're all in this together to see greater freedom and justice and peace come about. But you know, the great difficulty in organizing is you do have a number of you have egos in the room, you have perspectives in the room, you have different histories in the room. You know, how do we harmonize these things rather than turning it into a cacophony, you know, a chaotic mess? And that is really where spiritual maturity is born out. That we adopt practices that make us better listeners, I think, than pontificators, you know, people who demand things be done a certain way. I think we embody practices where we speak for ourselves rather than for others. Practices where we try to coordinate our shared gifts and not compete. And this has to be applied, you know, in specific contexts. And so I can't just come up with, a 10-point plan for, you know, this could happen in a church community. It could happen in a denominational association. I will say there's some great work being done on the Baptist front. The New Baptist Covenant, I think, is a great group of people who are doing this kind of work. I'd say I have to, you know, give a shout out to my Alliance of Baptist friends. I know they often get labeled as the liberal Baptist group, but they're doing some great work for justice and peace. And I wish that all peace-seeking churches, whether liberal or conservative, would keep their eyes on the prize a little bit more. I think the CBF, Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, that's meeting in Atlanta in a few days, I think they're doing some wonderful things as well.
Okay.
And they've been collaborating quite a bit with the New Baptist Covenant as well. But organization isn't easy. Organizing isn't easy. It's you're coordinating different people and different objectives sometimes, and you really have to try to shape a common vision. And at the same time, give people the freedom that they need to be using their gifts and bringing their perspective toward the objective of being fruitful. But that's a difficult and yet rewarding tension to manage.
Yeah, so in the few minutes we have left, tell us what Daniel Wilson is involved with in the Williamsburg area and the surrounding area in terms of addressing these issues, and what are the things we should be looking out for, and what can we join in and participate with?
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you're in the Williamsburg area, there's a number of things going on. We've got I'll just leave off the political action groups because for obvious reasons. But there are some political action groups that are doing some good things that don't necessarily involve candidates and campaigning. They're working on moral issues, and that deserves to be mentioned. But at the same time, we have the Lemon Project at the College of William & Mary that's doing some fantastic things in recovering our shared history. Colonial Williamsburg has a wonderful program of African American history, and let me also say it's really American history. So Stephen Seals has done a great job with that, and he's just been he's just taken on a new role as the historic character James Lafayette. But they're doing some wonderful things to help us see our shared American history at UW. Here in this church, we're looking at a number of different possibilities to get involved in. We already host a forum that is not based out of the church. We host it, so we offer physical space, and I happen to be on the board of this group called All Together. All Together was started after the Rodney King trial, not the trial of Rodney King, the Rodney King beating and the consequent trial of the officers involved. And it was started as a community forum to educate about racial justice and racial issues. That group has been going on. The NAACP continues to do its work here. They meet at First Baptist Church across the street. There is the Black Lives Matter chapter. We're still dreaming up big ways of impacting our community. Our Village is another group that's been doing a lot of racial reconciliation that I haven't been as involved with because they it's hard to get to their meetings on Monday nights for me. It doesn't really work with my schedule and my four kids. But they're doing some wonderful work, and I have some lovely friends who are working with them. But yeah, there's some great things. We've been working on trying to build better relations with our police force here. There have been a number of opportunities to do that, as well as the hiring of a new chief for Williamsburg Police Department. So yeah, there's a number of things going on right now that we're addressing in our community. We have a great group of co-conspirators and co-collaborators trying to seek a more just and peaceful Williamsburg and Williamsburg area, James City County and New York County.
Great. Well, thank you, Daniel, for this enlightening discussion today. And certainly in the future, we're going to have you back because your name. I wrote down some points that can be expounded on in more in depth, and we're going to get to them sometime in the next 6 months or so.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today. We look forward to you tuning in next Thursday when we'll be broadcasting live from the Navajo Reservation in Cove, Arizona. Have a blessed week.